Accession number 22099, Reel 8.
Reel 5, Side 1, Captain David Render.
So, having found that I'd got my eyesight after all, much to my surprise, we then tried to back up and get out of the field that we were in, but we, unfortunately, it came on to rain, and when we tried to come back up the dike to get back up onto the road, the tank just wouldn't have it. And so I was absolutely a dead duck and being heavily shot at. There were a lot of rounds coming over. And suddenly it stopped. And I couldn't, well, I just, it suddenly stopped. The thing stopped firing. And so suddenly over the air came the voice of Harry Heenan, who was our 3 troop in the regiment, by the way, in A Squadron. We had 4 troops of tanks, 2, 3, 4 and 5. The 2 troop was a chap called Mike Howden, older than we were. Harry Heenan was the same sort of age, 20 or that sort of age, and Dickie Holman, who's recently died, and you probably saw his obituary in the Telegraph, and he also had a brother, by the way, who was a major, who was a squadron leader in charge of C Squadron, and myself as a troop leader for 5 troop. And over the air came this voice of Harry Heenan in 3 troop, and he said, "Hello, 5, how about that then?" So I said, "Have you stopped that thing firing?" He said, "Yes, I've just done it in. How about that?" So I said, "Oh my goodness, thanks ever so much. I'll owe you a drink for that. Thank you very much." But then, of course, we did help each other a lot, particularly Harry Heenan and Dickie Holman and myself. They saved my life on occasions, and no doubt I saved theirs on occasions too. Things like Kievelberg, you know, helping out other people who are in trouble. So it was the order of the day. But for all that, it was a very, very close call from my point of view. Subsequently, I realised that that must have been an AK-AK gun that was firing at me, or at least they'd only got HE. They probably expended their AP in the first round or two and missed, fortunately. Hence those big trenches that appeared on the side of the tank in the ground. But the rest of it was HE, which was being fired and hitting the tank and knocking all the little bits of prisms and goodness knows what off. Anyway, it suddenly stopped and Harry Heenan said he'd done it. Well, I then managed to get the tank back up and out of the way. And then over the air came the news that Harry had got back into... In fact, he had got out of his tank when he knew what was going on, and he was over sort of left forward of myself, and he came in at right angles to the direction of the gun that was firing at me, and through a wood he trundled his tank very quietly and carefully. And they aimed the gun carefully through the trees at this gun, which was a huge, great AK-AK gun, a mobile thing, with, as I understand it, somewhere near about 20 men around it, because they had to have a lot of men to bring up the ammo and that sort of stuff and fire it. And he then fired an HE straight into it and killed all the blokes and immobilised it. And then, highly delighted, he went back to his tank and clambered up onto it, and he was sitting on the turret ring somewhere and spoke to me and said, "How about that?" and all that sort of thing that I've just related. And just after that, he had a Sten gun or a Schmeisser in his hand. I don't know which it was. The Schmeisser, incidentally, was the German machine pistol, which fired 18 rounds of ammunition in the same way of 9mm, which was exactly the same as that ammunition that was fired with a Sten gun. And he dropped it, and it went straight down on the floor of the tank, and of course the bolt of the Sten gun or the Schmeisser was a very heavy thing on a fairly light spring, and once it fired, it continued. It would go automatically, and this is what it did, and it fired straight up him and killed him. So I never ever had the opportunity to thank my friend Harry Heenan. He is now actually in the cemetery at the Jonkerbos in Holland, which incidentally was one of the cemeteries which was daubed, if you please, by the lunatics over there with Nazi swastikas. I mean, what on earth they thought they were doing, I don't know, but the Dutch took that very hard indeed and had it all cleaned off. But nevertheless, that was that's where Harry Heenan is. So that was my episode at Nijmegen. After that, the squad, his troop was taken over by a chap called David Alderson, who had been a troop leader under instruction with me. He was with me for probably about 3 or 4 weeks, actually, just sort of tagging along to see how to fight battles and what, how it was done. And so he then stepped into the breach as troop leader, and he did very well in because shortly after that we moved on, and we went down to Shinnen and Beacon, so on that area, Beacon, and then on down to Shinnen and so on, and Hengelo, and then we came up to Geilenkirchen, in just in the German border. And of course, again, I had a bad time there, as I'll tell you in a second. But in fact, if we're talking about David Alderson, he did very well. He actually went in and he actually took, he was the first tank troop into Geilenkirchen and took it. Unfortunately, in the November, he did actually get lost a tank there and was suffering from shock, but he came back again quite quickly. But then in the November, so he only lasted really from the end of September to November, because he got a lump of shrapnel in his neck, and he got wounded, in other words, and he was sent back to England, so we lost him quite quickly. He only lasted about a month or so.
But before we go on to Geilenkirchen, was Nijmegen the first time that you'd worked in the field with the Americans?
Yes. Yes. Nijmegen was, and then, but subsequently we worked in the field with a new division, which was in Geilenkirchen, and this was the 333rd Infantry Division of the 84th Infantry Regiment of the 84th Division. That was the second time we worked with the Americans. So now we talk about Nijmegen, yes? I would just talk, by the way, just for a second about David Alderson. You might think that that was a fairly short spell of his of life for him. Well, he didn't get killed. He came on and he was post-war. He's only just died, as a matter of fact. In the year 2000, year 2000, April 2000, he died. But you have to remember that, I think I mentioned earlier, that the casualties for the Sherwood Rangers was in Normandy and Germany, and up to Germany, we had to keep, say, 18 officers in the line fighting. Our casualties were 67 killed and wounded. So when they start talking about the bombers losing 60%, perhaps ours 250% or whatever it works out to puts it all into perspective. There were occasions when some of these chaps joined us on the Monday morning, first thing, and by midday they were dead. We've had that on several occasions. So you can imagine, really, what my thoughts are about being still alive after all that lot. Anyway, we now go to Geilenkirchen. Okay. Well, we were told to advance onto Geilenkirchen from, I think it was a place called Pallenberg, actually. I'm not quite sure where I'm talking about, really. But it was, we were told to attack on the road north of Geilenkirchen. And we'd had a few days out, two or three days out. Because don't forget, on average, we did about 10 days in action and 5 days out. That was roughly our program. And we slept most of the 5 days out, I might tell you. Because our days were very long when we were in action. In Normandy, they would be from about 4 o'clock in the morning till about 1 o'clock if the O group with the infantry bloke who couldn't understand what we were doing went on a bit long. So you only had a few hours sleep, 3 or 4 hours sleep, and you're at it again. If we just talk about Nijmegen, when I was told that I was the lead troop by John Semkin, I had to advance down this road towards Geilenkirchen. And to be honest, I got up late and I went into action in my pyjamas because I'd got out of bunk about a bed a bit late. And I got severely ticked off by John, hurry up, get on with it sort of thing. And because of that, I had a momentary lapse of attention, if you want the honest truth, because I drove, made the tank go straight forward, and being in the lead, as usual, I went straight into a series of mines in the road. And I, of course, blame myself for that, really, because if you were alert, and alert you had to be when you were advancing into something like that, one of the things you did was you put the binoculars low down on the curbs as you were going along. So you'd look forward and look down. It's rather like driving the car, where you drive around a corner and you look at the corner, but in the next second you're looking at the traffic lights well ahead, sort of thing. But you do that sort of thing with your binoculars. Well, in fact, a German minefield would always be marked on their side by a little board about 8 inches square or something like that, with a little post on the back driven into the ground. And if you could look on their side of it, there would be Achtung Minen written on it with a skull and crossbones on. And so they would put that up, you see, so that they wouldn't drive into it themselves. But from our point of view, there was nothing. So anyway, I drove straight into this thing on this road, and what the Germans did was they would link the tellers together. In other words, there would be, say, three rows of two or more, and they would be wired together. And they would be arranged in such a way, as happened with me, where you could run over the first two or three rows of them without anything happening. But when you got to the row nearest their first row, but your last row, the things would go off, and then it would set off all the others automatically. Well, this is what happened, and there was a most enormous roar, and all great black clouds of smoke came up with sparks and everything else past my face and so on. And in fact, the engines of the tank were blown clean out. Both engines were blown out, and the door behind the driver, because you realise there was an escape hatch below the driver at his back, came up and tore his back clean out and killed him. But the rest of us got out okay. We were a bit wary about where we were walking because, of course, we knew we knew we were in a minefield. By this time, there was a bit of shooting going on, and so we were a bit under fire, but not particularly. I remember being... You realise, of course, that any... crew on either side, as soon as they bailed out, they were shot at. I mean, we automatically shot at the crew because we didn't want the blighters to go back into another tank again. And that was the position with them. I might say, as another little aside, we were all issued with tank suits at this sort of time, and I always wore a tank suit over my uniform because we never, over my battle dress, if that's what I'd gone on underneath, because we never wanted to show our badges of rank, because there was always the danger that if you bailed out and you got captured, the Germans would shoot you out of hand because you were a lieutenant. They didn't want you back in again. I must say we didn't do that, but they were reputed to do it, and so most of us, we didn't do that. In the same way, by the way, since we're talking about that sort of thing, one always went into action with your sleeves rolled down, never with your sleeves rolled up, because 20% of your body gets burnt, you're a dead duck. Well, you obviously got burnt in your face and your neck and so on. And if you've got your sleeves rolled up and you've got your arms burnt, you were getting on the, well on the way towards 20% of your body being burnt, which was certain death. So in the circumstances, we always used to go with our tank suits on and so on. Anyway, going back to the Geilenkirchen episode, we bailed out, and we then ran back to base, and that was that. Subsequently, we had to do an advance, and we got towards a road. I mean, to be honest about it, half the time I can't say exactly where it was because one road leads into another. And there were a number of mines about, and we cleared these mines and so on, sort of chucked them away and that sort of thing. And we were with the Americans, and they were quite nice about things to us. I've got a little article there on a book. That then went back and somewhat sort of shaken by some of this, because actually when the mine goes off and you know there's a bang and all that sort of stuff, you get a bit, I don't say shaky, but you're certainly, you know, a bit sort of edgy, to put it mildly. And of course you know jolly well you've got to get back in another blooming tank, which is always a bit of a problem, and also you've just lost one of the chaps that you've been talking to just about an hour ago, or half an hour ago, or a minute ago, and all of a sudden he isn't anymore, and that becomes a sort of brutal realisation of what the dickens you're doing. But that's no more or less than people just dying anyway, and of course that's how we took it all the time. I mean, okay, he's dead and that's it, I suppose. There were no, I must admit I was very, very upset about Harry Heenan at Nijmegen, I don't know, within a day or so you've forgotten all about it again, and you go on, and a lot of it comes back later. Anyway, I then went back, and I found the colonel. He was in a house, and I just walked in, and he was talking to the brigadier, if you please, and I said, "Here, I want another tank. I don't know what you chaps do," because they were sitting there having a glass of wine over a jolly good battle that was going all right from their point of view. And suddenly this twit walks in and starts leading off about, "It's all right for you buggers sitting here drinking wine, but what about me?" You know? And the colonel never forgot that. He was always laughing about it, of course. And because actually Stanley Christopherson, there was with the upper brass of the Sherwood Rangers, there was, and that included, to me, people like John Samkin and Jack Holman and all these sort of people, older chaps who were not actually the troop leaders but the older part of the regiment. They were always very, very compassionate to the young blokes. I did ask one of the one of my crew one day, this chap that I was talking about, the wireless operator. I said, what did you chaps think who'd been in the desert? What did you think about these young boys coming out, you know, age 19 and saying, well, I am a lieutenant and you do this and you do that. And you'd been through all this lot before and all through the war and all the rest of it. How did you get on with it? And what did you think about the troop leader sticking his, you know, sticking his head out? And he just said to me quite simply, he said to me, perfectly honest, he said, we just felt sorry for you. Because, of course, they knew how long we were going to last. On average, of course, the troop leader lasted for about a fortnight. That was about the average time for them. Not once the thing got moving and more fluid, but certainly in Normandy time. And so we've now done Nijmegen. Well, now the Germans began to react much more violently about us being in Germany. And after that episode of Geilenkirchen, we then started to move. That was sort of south, Geilenkirchen was.
So could I ask what dates Geilenkirchen was?
Geilenkirchen would be... Just one moment, please. Sorry, I've got to refer to this. November. November 44. Because then we moved back for Christmas time to Schinnen, and then we proceeded to do an attack on the Reichswald. This now is in early 1945, in January 1945. And there is a picture here of our tanks lined up, firing. We fired all, literally all day long at this thing, off and on. And I have actually... got here somewhere. I don't know if I can find it. Perhaps if you can just give me a minute. We lined the tanks up and indirectly we fired, and I have the actual records of it showing that my tank fired off 3 tons of ammunition in that one day. And the number of rounds and everything else. I'm sorry, I'll have to hunt around somewhere else to find out where I put that. So that what we were firing at, I just do not know. I can't tell you what we were looking, what we were firing. We just had to fire on fixed lines. Operation Pepper Pot, it was called, on the Ruhr Valley.
So was anybody doing the spotting for you, or was it just a case of you were firing?
No, we just had to fire at certain... they gave us certain elevations to fire at. I don't know where they went at all. We just fired all day long. I'll have to turn up some other papers to get that for you, if you want to see that. So now we're talking about the attack on Cleve. Well, at this time, the colonel had decided that I would be his LO, liaison officer, in Ahamba. And we, the regiment just drove straight towards Cleve, and I remember that we went in on a road where there was a bank on one side. I've tried to find it, by the way, since and can't, and houses on the left. And to be honest about it, there was a lot of firing going on, and I can remember German soldiers rushing down this bank and being shot up as they did, just doing a sort of mad charge at our column of vehicles. I was right behind the colonel in Amber scout car. No, I think I might have had a machine gun on it, but that's about all. Anyway, we are parked opposite these houses, and there were vehicles exploding in front of us, you know, three or four vehicles up, just like that. A soft vehicle would go and then a tank or something. And it was quite frightening, really. And then all of a sudden, there was a whacking great bang or crack, and the inside of the armoured car in which I was sitting there, minding my own business, because there wasn't much for me to do. I couldn't do anything. I mean, I was just waiting for instructions of what I was supposed to do with the colonel. I mean, I really didn't know what I was supposed to be doing as an LO anyway. I mean, I was just there, you know, the sort of thing. A runner, I suppose, I don't know, but he never used me. But the point was that the inside, I'd got the lids open, and the inside of this armoured car was suddenly bathed in a white light. And this terrific crack, you see, and I thought, God, what was that, you see? So I poked my head up, and I looked to the left, between two houses, there was the most enormous Jag Panther. A Jag Panther, incidentally, was an SP, self-propelled gun, with either he got an 88 or he got a long 75 squeeze gun. I don't know which it would be. I think it was probably an 88. A lot of 88s they had on their tanks, of course, particularly on the SPs. So I would imagine it was probably an 88. And what in fact had happened was that this thing was driving up and down the gardens of the houses, you see, and when he saw a gap, he just turned right immediately, and there was a vehicle in front of him, and it was like picking off ducks, wasn't it? So he just fired. Well, he turned right opposite where yours truly was sitting in his armoured car, which was only a little thing, of course. And he fired at it at point-blank range. I mean, you're talking about the distance between, shall we say, the depth of the house and a small front garden. So, I mean, the range would have been, I don't know, what would you say, 25 yards, 30 yards, you see? And, of course, I realised almost immediately afterwards what the thing was all about. The white light was the trace. So I reckon of the AP. So I reckon the trace went over my head about 6 or 8 inches to illuminate the inside of the tank. And I would say that that was probably another one of my 9 lives that went for a Burton there. And the reason, of course, why it didn't hit me was because he couldn't depress the gun low enough. Because they had limited depression and limited lateral movement, 14 degrees I think it was, and they relied on that from the fact that they got super gearboxes, epicyclic gearbox, and they could manoeuvre the whole tank very easily and very quickly. It took the place of a turret, of course. But the position was that there was no chance. And of course the next minute he'd gone. You see, because he just fired a shot and then pissed off next away somewhere else. So that gives you an idea of how lots of these encounters took place when we just swanned into the blue without any proper infantry protection or anything. I mean, vehicles on a road like that, and you couldn't go off the road particularly because there was nowhere to go. There were ditches and all the rest of it. And also we had soft vehicles with us. But it gives you an idea of the, shall we say, one has to admit it, the sort of resourcefulness of the Germans, who stuck at nothing. I mean, to be sort of doing that sort of thing within inches or feet or whatever it was, yards of a complete armoured regiment was some going for one vehicle. As far as we can make out, there were only one or two or so of them about, that's all.
Did somebody get him?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I expect they did in the end, but I mean, I don't know. I never saw it. It did a lot of damage to the Sherwood Rangers because he shot up quite a few vehicles. But we did have a lot. I mean, there were a lot of Germans running about. I mean, we just drove straight into them, don't forget, which was, of course, our habit. But, so, That was Cleve. Now, we then went on to Gok, and I think that Gok, it was at Gok where we suddenly had a most terrific stonk, and a tremendous amount of firing was going on, and nobody was actually specifically hit, but we sort of, apparently, I don't forget, I was LO, so I wasn't in a tank at this moment, and